So even though, that was really a very interesting case study. I've heard bits and pieces of it in the past, but you always pick up new things. I hope you all noticed the close distance between the fields and the cement kilns, because geography, location, are absolutely critical. So even though I've titled this Tips for Growers, really I'm thinking of everybody as an organizer, because these are the tips that organizers, extension folks, industry folks who deal with a clientele should take back to their clientele on how to start recycling programs. So that's what I'm going to do. So my target audience are really prospective organizers, current or future champions of local recycling initiatives, because you need those local champions to have a program. As Keith's case studies showed, it doesn't always make strict economic sense for industry. You need to have the champions coming from every direction in order to move this forward. So what I'm going to start with is basically this, give you some background on recycling, some arguments for why recycle, why recycling hasn't been happening, some things how to get started, and some information on recycling markets. The last slide has a list of resources where people can go and increasingly go to as we fill out those resources to get some of the educational materials, the rationale, presentations that have been given on recycling programs. So what does recycling involve? There are several different steps carried out that go under the auspices of recycling. And all of these are steps in recycling. The material that is taken for recycling is recyclate, or it's recyclable material. But it's not recycled until something happens with it at the end, until it becomes a product. The product might be to use, the product might be oil, it might be something tangible, but only then are things recycled, once they've gone to that end spot. So the other thing about this, all these people are called, you know, you say, oh, that's a recycler. But in fact, there are a number of different stages, steps, and roles that people, companies play. Often the same company will play more than one role, some level of vertical integration that makes it more economically feasible, but there are very different steps. And if anybody goes back home and says, oh, I'm starting a recycling program, get that word out, you're going to get calls. Most of those calls will be from people who are called brokers, who will say, I'll take the material and I'll sell it. The reality is at that point, they probably will call me or Gene and say, well, what do I do with it? Because there are limited markets for most agricultural plastics. So you're looking for specific kinds of end markets, all of which are recyclables. Processors, so the first material gets picked up, it gets hauled. Curbside plastics get hauled to what's called a MRF, a material recovery facility, and there they're dispersed. Agricultural plastics are almost never picked up curbside, so they'll go directly to a processor or maybe even to an end market. What the processor will do is agglomerate it somehow. They'll shred it, in some cases, big pieces like Keith described. In some cases, it'll be ground up, sometimes densified, and sometimes made into pellets. What I've found is when I deal with recycling markets for agricultural plastics, where there are so many problems and little bits of potential economic margin, that if we can avoid processes like the expensive process of going to pellets, there's more economic feasibility in it. Any questions about just that basic sense of what the steps are in recycling? Or to go on. Okay, so this is another way of looking at background. When you're talking about agricultural plastics, in fact, you're talking about a number of different kinds of resins. The most common resin these days is low-density polyethylene. If you look at the bottom of your bottles, it says number 4. That's what we're talking about here. And they're used to make everything from covers on tunnels and greenhouses to the mulch film on the ground, as well as many things in the dairy industry, bale wrap, silage bags, bunch of silage covers, and horticulture using also maple syrup tubing in the Northeast. That's actually low density polyethylene, which has more stretchability than other rigid plastics. Many kinds of irrigation tubing, also low density polyethylene. The number two, HDPE, which has stronger markets than the film plastics, that goes into many of the containers, nursery containers, thicker irrigation tubing, some drip tape. Polypropylene, number five, is woven polypropylene of the super sacks that he showed you, the big bags that other things get put into. Those are being used now in places, burlap sacks and other things that are used just ubiquitously in transporting food, feed, bird feed, everything, and then they are high quality polypropylene and actually can be recycled. Some nursery cups are also polypropylene, and the nursery cups are more brittle than polypropylene. Polystyrene is used in seasoning plug trays. PVT is against the law to use for food grade in the United States. However, it is used in a lot of imported products, and I'll show you an example of that in a bit. But you do see it in the drainage as often that. So here's a sample of different kinds of stuff. Without a water jug, I show you that the things that are polyethylene and polypropylene will float. PVC and others will stink. And so if you're talking to someone in the field and you say, we don't take PVC, polyvinyl chloride, which most plastics recycled do not want to touch for a variety of reasons. Just to take out a bottle of water, see what sinks and see what floats. And the grower themselves can differentiate, as can the organizer. And then you start going, oh, I see that one's purple. That's you know, after a while, you'll get used to what's going on. But people also think you're very smart. They might even give you a Nobel Prize by showing this very simple sink flow test, but it works and it's very effective. The vertical axis on here was sort of my guesstimate of what's cleaner or what's dirtier. A while back, cleanliness and dirtiness were really the differentiation about what could be recycled and what couldn't. As I got deeper into it, I found out that really is not the only consideration by far. And also, it's something that can be improved. You can get go up higher by simple best management practices that I'll describe a little bit later. But this is sort of the layout of what kind of plastics we're talking about for agricultural plastics. So that's as much background as I'll give you. If you have questions, please ask. But that's the background of what the system is we're talking about. And then the argument, when you go out into the field and you say to growers, hey, you really should recycle your plastics, and they say, well, why? It's really a pain in the butt. There are several really strong arguments. One of them, well, three arguments that I'm going to make here. Conserve non-renewable resources. So plastics embody as much energy. They're made generally from fossil fuels, and they don't lose that energy. So they are as rich in energy, as rich as an energy source as gasoline. So you don't want to waste that in this era. Reduce the carbon footprint and protect health and the environment. Recycling really uses a fraction of the energy of extracted material. I've seen figures as high or low, but that 95% more energy is used for extracting virgin resources than to recycle. Now, I'm enough of a data curmudgeon that I'm not just going to accept that number, and I'm not going to give it to you as a firm hard number, because it really depends where you're putting your system, what you're measuring there. But just a small fraction of as much energy is used to recycle, even if you're shipping the recyclate across country to be processed. The difference there is, of course, money, not energy. And the third reason, and Keith started mentioning this, that if plastics are not recycled, what's going to happen to them? Well, in urban areas, they'll typically be thrown away. And if they're thrown away, they'll either go to a landfill or they'll go to a waste-to-energy plant. If they're not going via that route, they're going to be open. Agricultural plastics will be open-burned in fields, put in burn barrels. In dairy plastics, I think this might be, horticultural mulch film also, plowed into the soil. You find that in places were just sort of left around. And I think it was easier to leave plastic around in the old days when there was less of it. Cumulatively, we use so much plastic that it becomes a bigger and bigger issue. So when plastics are burned in open fields, this is some of the data that Keith was alluding to, open fires will smolder. So even though it used to be that EPAs would print on some of the plastics and the companies printed on the plastics, burn this one through, if you're burning in a clean environment, the way you would do it for a scientific study, it's true, you get carbon dioxide and water. But that's not how plastics are burned in the field. There's enough chlorine in the Earth's crust, in the air, in soil, so that the chemical reaction that happens picks up that chlorine and forms dioxins and furans, which are about the most toxic chemicals known. In very, very small quantities, they are carcinogens, they disrupt hormonal systems, disrupt the immune systems, very, very teeny amounts. So the deal is that open fires are typically 500 degrees Fahrenheit or cooler. They smolder, they create dioxins. Incinerated fires, where you're in a controlled environment, not only do they have scrubbers, but they're also at 1800 degrees, which will destroy chemicals and will not form dioxins and furans. So that's the difference. People say, well, why is that okay and this is not okay? It really has to do with the temperature of the burn much more than what is being burned. Make sense? But that's not the only emissions from these open fires. You get benzene, formaldehyde, PAHs, and particulate matter. The particulate matter will lodge in the lungs of people or animals and lead to heart attacks, strokes, a whole litany of health effects. And the issue is, okay, so clearly if there's a big forest fire out west, it's also having the same impact in the smoldering edges of it. But that's not near food and feed, people and animals. So I'm not saying go have forest fires, but I am saying that the environmental and health impacts have much more potential for causing damage when they happen on farms. And USDA did a study maybe 10 years ago on what is the main pathway for dioxins to get back into human beings in the United States, and it is through food. So the kind of diagram of flow diagram that I'm describing is in fact the dangerous one within the United States. And there's also an economic burden when used plastic is treated as garbage. We've discovered that what many people are doing now instead of open burning is they'll say, well, I hire a hauler. I put it in my dumpster. It gets taken away. Well, the haulers, who are often subcontracting with a large waste handling organization, they're suffering on the lightness of that load. It takes them more time traveling to be moving light loads of loose plastic, which are not compressed. So it's an economic burden on them. And in fact, I just happen to have read that all of the large waste handling companies, the recycling companies in the United States, lost nearly 20% revenues from 2015 over 2014. It's an issue, and I don't know that anybody has rigorously put it together about the lightness of the loads, but if you speak to anyone in the solid waste recycling business, they'll talk about the difficulty of handling loose plastic. It also wastes landfill space, and if you don't have the users of the plastic taking responsibility for the true costs of maintaining and building new landfills, that's going to come back to haunt communities which are suffering under the burden of waste. And one of the solutions to that is what Keith was describing, and what he was talking about actually was the formal name for it is extended producer responsibility. We have very little of it in the United States. So in fact, the industries that are producing material goods are not bearing the true cost of disposing of those goods. And that is coming to bear with plastics, which are very light, fluffy, they prevent the operation of landfills in the way they're intended to operate, proper drainage, the settling. So there are economic arguments that any organizer of a recycling program can use in building their team of who they want to work with to develop a recycling program. Save your community's money. But one of the reasons that recycling isn't really happening is that our landfill tipping fees are very low. In the Northeast, on the top line, this table, by the way, comes from the colleague Annie McMillan, who is from Vermont, and her state and mine, New York, are in the region where landfill tipping fees might be high enough to make people think about recycling. But look at the tipping fees elsewhere. So there's a lot of politics in this situation. And again, I recommend that organizers of recycling programs lobby for higher recycling landfill tipping fees that actually reflect the true cost of maintaining landfills. So I also think there are three different categories of other reasons why horticultural plastics aren't being recycled, in addition to the one I just gave, which is lack of incentive. But there are characteristics inherent to the plastics themselves. There are characteristics of the products after they're used in fields and nurseries. And there's the cost and logistics of collection and transport from the fields or from nurseries to recycling markets. So going through those one at a time. Characteristics of the plastics, and as those of you in industry know, and those of you in horticulture know also, that we're talking here about different mixes of resins. A market, your processor, needs to know what they're dealing with in order to deal with it well. And that's becoming increasingly difficult as the plastics are becoming more highly technical products developed to play a specific role within horticulture. As I said before, most of the plastic that's used is low-density polyethylene. But look at these two illustrations here with the PVC. So both of these are called irrigation drip tape. The one on the right is an imported drip tape that's polyvinyl chloride. The one on the left is polyethylene drip tape. Well, a user is not going to know this. I found out, one of them was labeled, but I discovered this because I was asking a lot of questions of the salesperson at a trade show to try to differentiate this. This information is not on the website selling the materials. The farmers are really very, and growers are really very unlikely to have looked into what resin the material is made from, and makes a lot of difference to the processor. So again, this thing flow test works really well, but this is just an example of why this is tough. These technical products, different resins take different markets. And then the list on the left are some of the characteristics built into various plastics. As I learned this from Keith talking last year, that some mulch films, very, very thin, already making them somewhat more difficult than other things to recycle. They are, on the high end, embossed, so they have better stretchability over raised beds. Well, that embossing creates a little pocket. That little pocket holds onto grit. You have something that's damp anyway, that grit's going to hold onto it, making it more difficult for a processor to deal with. Also increasingly, these very, very thin layers will probably be three different layers of plastic, with the one in the middle being an oxygen, or basically a gas barrier. And if that gas barrier is made of nylon, it can't be recycled because nylon melts at a much higher temperature than polyethylene, so most processors can't use it. If that barrier layer is EVOH, the processor can use it. It can be recycled. It melts at about the same temperature, but it has different characteristics than polyethylene, so it really only works if you have less than 10% of it in your mix. Well, this is getting pretty technical, and certainly people will often say, well, why don't you just go make it back into film? Well, you can't go make it back into this highly technical product with multiple extrusion layers, but this is some of the characteristics of the plastic that people like you were selling or using that make it difficult to recycle. Second group of characteristics are what happens to the plastic when it's being used. So after plastic is used in the field, or after it's used really for anything with an end market, it's called post-consumer. And then it really depends how that consumer uses the plastic. Most material that's recycled, whether it's plastics or wood, whatever, is post-industrial. So to give the example from diapers, this is a nice, easy example. When diapers are manufactured, here I'm talking about something like Pampers, the combination plastic, paper, and God knows what else diapers, they're manufactured in strips. And then a cutter goes through and cuts them into the diaper shape. Well, the cutout is post-industrial recyclate, and that can fairly easily be reused. But we certainly don't reuse the post-consumer diaper. Most other things that we're talking about here are not as bad as diapers. They can be reused, but it's an entirely different picture. Well, all horticulture, agricultural plastics are post-consumer. And their use is outdoors, almost by definition, for most of them. And therefore, they're exposed to all the elements. And in terms of collection, they're dispersed across a rural landscape, which makes collection costs much higher than if you were in a factory and there were pallets, and their pallets were wrapped with stretch wrap, and the stretch wrap is taken off and put into a bin at the side of the warehouse. That's much easier to collect, and it's also going to be cleaner than agricultural plastics. So that and one other that I'll mention are what I mean by the characteristics of plastics after their use. The other is that there are very likely to be weed seeds, soil pathogens, possibly residues of chemicals and other and pesticides and other chemicals on material that's been used in the field. It's unknown. You know, some of it has been tested and is known to be somewhat clean, but weed seeds, if they're taken from a infected field and brought to a field or an area that is non-infected, that creates a risk that none of us would want to be involved with. So those are some of the issues, the characteristics put up there. But one of the exciting things along these lines is that more and more work has been done to deal with these characteristics. And my friend Paul Vanderpool has developed this wash line that is much less expensive than any others that I've seen. And he says, so he and his father installed plastic recycling systems around the world, and they developed this wash line. And Paul's assessment is that recyclers have learned how to recycle better. So there's new equipment that's coming out. There's ways to deal with both of the two problems that I just mentioned, the characteristics of the plastics themselves, which will take processors who are willing and able to deal with those characteristics and who are making appropriate end products, including BTUs, that can deal with mixes like that, and the characteristics and the field. This wash line took dirty, dirty mulch film. I supplied it myself. I know how filthy it was, which is on the left. And less than a minute later, came through this wash line looking like the material on the right, which was clean enough to recycle back into higher-end goods. I never would have believed it possible. I used to be very opposed to the idea of washing mulch film because just think how thin it is, so the surface-to-volume ratio is atrociously high. It's very, very filthy. I wouldn't have thought it possible. I saw it not only possible, but happening, and we're looking to get this kind of wash line. It's cost in the vicinity of a couple of $100,000. Might sound like a lot of money, but it's much less costly than they used to be. Out there with processors who can then take this material and do whatever with it. It becomes very high quality. So new technologies and advances in processing equipment are making it possible to deal with agricultural plastics. We still need many more pieces to come together in who's doing things. The stickler in recycling agricultural plastics, and I think the real reason for the difficulty in having them recycled, is the cost and logistics of collection and transport, moving them from the field to recycling markets. This, for anybody who is thinking about being an organizer in the field, this is the stickler, and this is what we have to work together to overcome. And here's an example of sort of what I mean. I took this picture at my local extension, county extension office, and they were hosting a 3-day drop off your plastic pot event, and then a local market who has since gone out of business was going to take it and make it into a special kind of low-grade plastic lumber. Well, it took about 40 staff hours, well, person hours between staff and volunteers to load this truck, stack up plastic pots, get them on the truck, and all for, I think it was 1,400 pounds. You know, just economically not only not feasible, but ridiculous. You're not going to find a group of people more eager to recycle than your backyard gardener. But actually dealing with those pots is a real problem because they're different shapes, different sizes. We need to get industry more involved to get standardized shapes, active use of the label of what kind of plastic it is, and more programs to make this easier. What you actually do with the recommended way of handling these is to stack them as best as possible, nest them, put them on a pallet, nail end pieces to the pallet and wrap the whole thing with pallet wrap, and you can, if you're within a couple of hundred miles of a recycler, that becomes feasible to handle. This really wasn't. So the next year, by this time we had gotten compactors, and I said, well, this isn't going to be necessary, we'll just put it into the compactor. Well, you need quality control, because one of the things that happened was a crescent wrench ended up in between two compressed pots, and it almost ruined the shredding equipment of the very generous processor. So quality control is something that one must think about. So those are the caveats of why not to get started, but here's what you need to get started. And not necessarily in this order, but this order works. And I'm going to go into detail on these as we go forward. Who do you want on your team? If there's a market in your area that says they may be or show potential interest in recycling agricultural plastics, get them on the team from the get-go, because they're going to help direct you what needs to happen to work with that market. You want your champions out of the Ag Horticultural Extension Service or something similar, or for places where that doesn't exist, and rarely can someone be devoting all their time to this. You want an ag or hort educator who's willing to devote some of their time to pulling together this team. Solid waste and recycling agency or business from the area. What I've discovered, I thought that, oh, sure, you get those on board, you know, they have this role. Well, every county I've dealt with has a different relationship with solid waste and recycling. Some have viable agencies, some contracted out, in some places it's completely privatized, in some it's multi-county, in some it's by town. It differs every place. Find out what the situation is in your area and get them on board. As I said, representatives from any viable plastics recycling market, conservation service by whatever name it's called in your area, as well as any other ag and horticulture support agencies, and leaders from among producers and farmers in the area. It's best if you can have one large nursery or someplace that can put out the word, and then as many others as possible. Markets prefer to work with largest of producers, but our clientele in the real world includes, in most areas of the country, many small producers as well. But getting that team together from different perspectives is invaluable, because any of our single perspectives, we really don't know what's going on among the others here, what else is happening. The team needs to become familiar with how plastics need to be prepared for recycling. You need to try it out, get out there in the field, and then begin to teach it. Basically, the thing is keep the plastic as clean, as dry as possible, shake out mechanically or by hand, depending on what you're working with, pebbles and clumps of soil. Again, unless you're handling it all in a mechanized fashion, roll it into pillows or bundles that can be stacked. Just by the process of stacking, you're going to get rid of a lot of the air. Store the stacked bundles out of the elements and not sitting on grit or gravel. And very important to separate the plastic by color and by type. Now, this becomes less important if you're dealing with a known market, because they'll tell you what they'll take, what they won't take, what can be pushed together. But if you don't know who you're dealing with, you've got to be very specific in what you separate out. And by the way, let me just go back to this. On the left over here is what not to do. This one of our champions was having a collection at his solid waste site. And even though he told people how they should deliver it, what he got when nobody was looking was just a bunch of junk on the left. Nobody wants to be faced with that. Quality control is really essential. This sequence here is from one of our first experiences in doing a collection. We were young and naive and didn't really know what to tell people. So we just said, take off some greenhouse cover, keep it clean for us. So number one in the upper left shows greenhouse cover piled on trailers. It looks great until we try to bale it. And what we're showing here is the bale that's Dennis Sutton on the right of the picture, on the upper right. He developed a Bigfoot baler, and one of David Cox, who I was working with at the time, on the left. And we tried to load it in the baler. It was a total mess and it took 4 hours. Totally ridiculous. We've since discovered that when it's piled into bundles, especially if these bundles are stacked, it takes a half an hour. It's all the difference in the world in terms of the efficiency of doing this when you don't have big mechanized grapple hooks. Pesticide containers, I just left this slide in here because if anybody is dealing with pesticide containers, should utilize the website of the Ag Container Recycling Council. It tells you exactly what to do in terms of best management practices. I find that those tend to be followed by many people, whether or not they're recycling, but pesticide containers, if they're not prepared prior to recycling or prior to throwing them away, will have pesticide residues in them. So promoting the Ag Container Recycling Council protocols is really the way to go. Next, in terms of getting started, you need some means of compacting plastic to take it to market. The exception to the rule there will be dictated by a large market nearby to some fields. If that's not the case, you really do need a means of compacting it. For the most part, I've used the Bigfoot BF300 balers, which is not shown in these pictures, but the picture on the right shows a version of the Bigfoot designed specifically for removing greenhouse covers, and it does so magnificently. It just slurps them off the field to remove a 300-foot plastic from a 300-foot greenhouse in 5 minutes, make a full bale of 1,000-plus pounds within half an hour. It's quite incredible. But there aren't that many of them around. On the left, are the one on top is a roller that's removing and rolling up a grain bag out west. I have not yet experimented to see how these would work with greenhouse covers, but it's on my to-do list because some of these rollers are now able to compact in tight enough rolls that they make a viable 40,000-pound truckload despite being enrolled and not bales. You're going to need a different kind of roller for removing mulch film, one that doesn't pull as hard because the mulch film is thin and will rip, than a greenhouse cover. But this is an area that I'm still pulling together data about and would welcome any input if someone knows. But anyone who's organizing a program in the field needs to know, well, how am I going to compact this stuff so that someone will want it? Because believe me, a dumpster doesn't alone do it. If, however, you're following the practice of just simply rolling it into bundles and stacking them, that will become a relatively compact pile that can be held down with twine or stretch wrap. Storage and a staging area for loading. We didn't realize how important this was when we got going, and then little by little, as we had to deal with this, it reared its ugly head and became very difficult to deal with. So I recommend thinking ahead of time. You need space to store 60 or more balers and have space for a tractor trailer to maneuver in that area. It should be a covered space with a clean base, because if the bales are left on grit or gravel, it will pick that up and lose value immediately. It should have room to store pallets and use pallets. There should be quality control when the plastic is accepted, otherwise you're going to find the mess that I showed you in a previous slide. And then it needs a loading dock and bale loading equipment. And it needs to be located in a place that's central for the growers to bring the plastic, or if the program is going to pick up the plastic, to bring it back. And it was surprising how few places we could find that had all met all these criteria. So the most likely people to be dealing with to find a place like that are industry, farm supply stores, solid waste and recycling centers. And still, it's possible that you're going to come up short. If you are able to find a warehouse or barn to store the material in, there are portable loading docks that make it possible, or one can be built by just compacting soil up and having a rock base, you know, up to a loading dock height. And then you need to find markets. So as I say, if you can find the market ahead of time, you're better off. But if you can't, that's okay. You can do all these other things and then seek a market. My experience in finding markets is that some seem very possible, and then they vaporize by the time you need them. So it isn't necessary that you get them first, because they might not be the same ones as you find later on. So I'm going to run through a few markets and a little bit of show and tell to show you what's possible. The first group of markets are ones that we deal with in the Northeast. And here I'm showing them to you so that those of you in the Northeast can call these people, and those of you not in the Northeast can take this as an example of the kind of products that are appropriate to make from agricultural plastics, and as examples so that you can go knock on doors in your area of plastic processors and say, would you consider taking in agricultural plastics and trying to use it as an input to make your end product. So the one on the left is NBF Plastics. They're friends of mine. We've known each other for the entirety that they've been NBF Plastics, because I got them into the business. They previously were rubber recyclers, and we got them excited about the possibility of using agricultural plastics, and then discovered this particular technology called PIMS, powder and pressure molding, at the Plastics Recycling Trade Show a few years ago. And they've been working on developing boards that will be about half horticultural and agricultural plastics, and the other half will probably be a rubber styrene mix that gives extra strength. So I'm going to show you an example. Board shows a top and bottom skin that can be of one material, and then a honeycombed interior that can be of another another sample. And that interior particularly can be ugly stuff, can be any color, nobody cares, nobody sees. And it's lightweight because of the air in there, which also gives it the strength. So we've tried this with all kinds of horticulture and dairy plastics, tried it with boat wrap, which is the blue. Tried it with maple tubing, and it works great for all of those. We're hoping that they will go on board soon. I don't know exactly when, but it'll be a very exciting product that will hopefully be a substitute for marine-grade plywood. Dishashish Plastic Manufacturers, we're actually marketing most of our material to them. This is an intermediary, the person whose name is on the bottom, Ashish, who sells to a plastic bag manufacturer in Brooklyn, New York. Do you want to hold up the gray bag, not the one that has the print on it? Yes. So that bag has that grayish look because it's about 20% of ag bag, which is a white and black mix, and that's a garbage can liner. TerraWalks has just recently changed its location, so it's now being manufactured in the Northeast, in Indiana, with a much more exciting business model than they were using before, when it was an idea and the material was being shipped all around. I tried to bring a sample of this, but it was so heavy I didn't. The intent of this is to replace sidewalk pavers, and it's really quite a brilliant idea, a wonderful product, cost competitive when you take into consideration maintenance. Again, the number to call is on the bottom of this one as well. These pictures show just a corner of the plastic, about a ninth of the entire paver, which is about that big. Ultra Poly is one of the largest plastic recyclers in the United States, but up until now, they have been handling post-industrial high-density polyethylene. Then they got excited about using the pads from drilling surfaces, and then they got excited about possibly using greenhouse film. They've now processed about 10 truckloads of it, and they're pushing the envelope and looking into more things. You have greenhouse cover, contact David, and they want to work with organizers and large growers to actually show what to do and organize programs. I'll just quickly go through the rest of these slides, but this will be up there as other people to deal with. Delta Plastic is a major recycler based in Arkansas and working mostly in the South. Encore is the recycler that works hand in glove with Command Packaging. Want to hold up the bag with the print on it. They're making these things that I think are called smart bags. from recycled mulch film, but they're located in a hotbed of production in Southern California where many of the issues of the difficulties of pulling things together are dealt with because it's a hotbed and they're going in there with a mechanized grapple system and just picking up loose plastic. Flag Plastic is doing somewhat of the same in the South. They opened up sometime in 2014. Their end product will be pellets as opposed to a finished product like a bag. Netafim in California is recycling tubing and drip tape, but again, in the hotbed of California. Bride and Cordage in Minnesota is recycling their own and other baling twine, and they're making a product called Revolver, which is a cute name for the recycled twine. And they've been doing that now for a number of years. Blackmore is taking back pots and trays, recycling it into their own product, as, by the way, is Ultra Poly. They are also taking back rigid plastics. East Jordan Plastic is taking back a variety of rigid plastics. And then there are plastics to oil promises. I've yet to see a reality, but the promise is still an exciting one of taking mixed resin plastic and compressing it with some heat and turning it back into oil and resin. And then people are talking about adding plastic to biomass fuel pellets to give it more slip and slide and higher BTU value. Another promise. I don't know of any large-scale reality on that yet. And here's a list of, as I said, resources for people to utilize when you get serious about starting up that program in your area. And that is Ag Plastic Recycling 101.